and your house to warm your bed, to admire your brilliance, to stay with you at your side even against a mob. And that one thing is a love you have sorely abused. In a flash of temper, he snapped, there is also the matter of marriage vows. Vows you failed to honor. I shot back. My shot must have hit its mark because he buried his guilty face in his hands. Still, I gave him no quarter. He was, after all, the one who taught me that if blood must be drawn, you must strike at the most vulnerable place. You say you were lured to that woman's bed. Maybe you believe it, but I know better. His shoulders tensed, as if he would argue, but I stopped him with one word. Reynolds. I spit the name, dragging in a few ragged breaths. I couldn't place it at first. It buzzed about like a gadfly, stinging me until at last I remembered, all those years ago, how you went to taverns seeking out the man who'd passed a slander about you. I stood up from the sofa, arms crossed over myself as I paced. A nobody, you said at the time, a ne'er-do-well named James Reynolds, from whom you could have no satisfaction, and yet you wish me to believe it's only by happenstance that years later you fell into bed with that man's wife? Alexander colored.
How can you believe otherwise?
Because there's one thing I know about you. I whirled on him. You never forget an offense. Maria Reynolds was the wife of a man upon whom you wished revenge, and a relation to the Livingstons, too. She was an opportunity to strike a blow against several enemies at once, so you took it. Never mind the blow you dealt me, as long as you had satisfaction. A long silence followed, one so long that I didn't know whether to fear the chasm between us or welcome it. In the end, he denied nothing.
Betsy, I can never cease to condemn myself for this folly, and can never recollect it without disgust, but you cannot wish to subject our children to a childhood of separation and insecurity.
His childhood, he meant. The one that had left him with these dangerous vulnerabilities and destructive compulsions. But I wasn't the one to subject them to such a possibility, so I said, I wouldn't wish that. Yet, in trying to cure you of your fear of abandonment, I've somehow convinced you that you may do and say anything, and your Betsy will stay loyally at your side. I convinced myself, too. But I think it better, in times like these, for us to acknowledge that marriage is a choice, one made, every day, anew. And trust me when I say I don't know which choice I shall make come morning. Chapter 24 August, 1793, Philadelphia.
Bring out your dead!
In the high stink of summer, when Philadelphia's outhouses overflowed gutters and dammed up alleys filled with trash, an outbreak of illness emptied the streets of rioters. An illness that may well have prevented the overthrow of the government. For now, instead of mobs shouting in front of our house, we heard only clacking carts carrying fly-bedeviled corpses. Yellow fever. The same horrible illness that had killed Jenny. The fever started, they said, amongst the dock workers. They suffered chills and tremors that eventually gave way to blackened, bloody vomit. The illness spread swiftly, with fatal effect and without known cure. People in good health one morning would drop dead the next day. In the hurry to stop the spread of the contagion by getting the victims into a grave, some were likely buried alive. And when vinegar-soaked handkerchiefs and garlic offered little safeguard against the disease, everyone who could flee the city did so. Everyone, it seemed, but us. As late summer turned to early autumn, Hamilton believed the business of keeping the government going in the face of anarchy was more vital than ever. "Jefferson will make much of my supposed cowardice if I leave now. I have to set an example. If I flee, it will only increase the panic, which is depopulating the city and suspending business. But you and the children should go." He looked away when he said this, his profile a study in agony. And I realized that he was giving me permission, acknowledging my power to abandon him, as I had so recently threatened to do, all of it under the face-saving cover of exigency. No one would blame me for leaving the capital at a time like this. And after the crisis had passed, we could say, Mrs. Hamilton simply can't abide Philadelphia, but the secretary visits his children at the Schuyler home from time to time. That's how it was done in high circles. Perhaps I could make that choice. Perhaps I would make that choice. But I was not ready to make it today. We can rent a summer house a few miles outside the city, I suggested, close enough that you can return for work if need be. Encouraged by his nod of agreement, I added, and I could ride with you some days, except for the few free blacks in the city who volunteered. Nurses in Philadelphia cannot be had for any price. I'll help tend to the sick.
I cannot allow that. You're a mother with small children, and there's no known immunity to the disease.
Alas, he had no immunity to it either. The next day, returning from his office at the Treasury, he made it only 2 steps into the front door before falling to his knees and retching into a brass urn that normally held umbrellas. And at the head of the stairs, I nearly stumbled in an effort to get to him. Alexander! We left that night by carriage. The children piled atop one another like cordwood. Hamilton followed on horseback at a distance, fevered and sick, his back throbbing with pain. We made it only as far as our rented summer house, 2.5 miles from town, before he was in a near delirium. Please, God, don't let him die, I prayed, a panic seizing me. Whatever our troubles, I couldn't bear for him to die, perhaps especially because of our troubles, and all that remained unresolved between us. I sent straight away for a physician who was, by happenstance, an old friend of my husband's from the West Indies.
Am I done for, Nettie?
Hamilton asked Dr. Stevens. Glowing with fever, my husband complained of aches in his swollen kidneys.
It's yellow fever,
the doctor said,
which means you may seem to get better, but that is the crucial time.
He didn't have to explain why. It was only after sufferers of this ailment seemed to recover that they would suddenly jaundice, spew blood and black vomit, and die. And so the doctor said to me,
Send the children far away, all of them, even the baby.
I'd already sequestered the children in an adjoining house, bringing meals to the door and waving at the window, never letting them get close enough to spread the contagion. The mother in me refused the idea of sending my frightened children away in such perilous times, especially little Johnny, so recently weaned. Sending them away felt like asking me to amputate a limb. But I'd learned during the war that sometimes amputation was necessary. Alexander was in no condition to make the choice, so it fell to me to speak very frankly with my 11-year-old son, who would have to manage his siblings all on his own. Philip, I need you to take your brothers and sisters to the pastures. My son's eyes went wide. By myself? The fear on his face nearly broke my heart, but I couldn't let him see that I shared it. If you can drive the carriage as far as Germantown, you can stay with friends there. It's only a few miles, and your grandpapa will send a servant to fetch you the rest of the way. You can watch over the little ones and manage the horses just that far, can't you?
Why can't you and Papa come with us?
He asked from the window. Because your father is too ill, and I must care for him.
Father has a doctor to care for him.
Because Philip had always been a boy who laughed more easily than he cried, it wounded me to see his eyes fill with tears.
If you stay, won't you get sick too?
The doctor has many other patients to tend to, I said, and you mustn't worry about me. You're a young man now. You must be the man of the family while your father is ill. If his father died, he'd become the man of the family, in fact, before the age of 12, and it would be the worst calamity of his life. Better a mother die than a father.
It was a father who could provide for the children. Saving Hamilton was the best thing I could do for my babies. In Philadelphia, bodies had rotted in the streets. Husbands had abandoned wives in their sickbeds. Mothers abandoned sick children, and children forsook their doomed parents. That seemed to me a greater evil than death. And though I'd taught my eldest son many lessons at my knee, now was the time to teach him the most important of all. Semper fidelis. Always loyal. Always faithful. I'm not going to leave your father alone when he needs me. Get ready to go now. See your siblings to safety. Can we depend on you, Philip? Manfully, our boy swiftly wiped tears away and nodded with determination. Yes, Mother, I can do it. But you must come as soon as you can. We will, I promised, watching gratefully from a distance as he coaxed the children into the carriage that would take them away. My heart ached that I couldn't hug or kiss them in farewell, that I couldn't inhale the baby scent of their hair. And as the carriage rolled away, I wept bitter tears, fearing that our separation might be of the eternal kind. For what I'd not told Philip, nor even wished to admit to myself, was that I, too, now felt aches and chills. Inside the house, I found Hamilton submerged in a bath of cold water, his teeth chattering. It wasn't the treatment recommended by the city's foremost physicians, like Dr. Rush. But Dr. Stevens refused to induce vomiting or bleed my husband with leeches. No, he said that he'd successfully treated this fever with baths and bark tonics. And so that's what he did. He cared for both of us. Though I was barely aware of him because my head now throbbed intolerably and my eyes burned. Scorching heat stole my ability to think, as if I stood on the precipice of hell's fires. Then I was cold, so frightfully cold that not even the warmed Madeira wine the Washingtons sent us chased away the chill. My husband and I were put into bed together, as at this point it could do no harm. My poor Betsy, Alexander whispered beneath the blankets, trying to warm me within the embrace of his own trembling arms. He was trying to give me the last of his warmth, though he couldn't spare it. Now I've done this to you, in addition to everything else. It was this embrace, I think, that cracked the wall of anger I'd erected between us. It was our first truly intimate embrace in months, and I knew it might be the last. Together, we tossed and turned in sweat-soaked misery upon pillows that Dr. Stevens had stuffed with lavender, chamomile, and peppermint. Until, to our terror, we both awakened feeling better. No fever, no chills, no aches, not a trace of them. I'd gone to sleep so weak I couldn't walk, much less dress for breakfast. But now I had the appetite for a hearty meal and the energetic desire to cook it. Dr. Stevens forbade that we should exert ourselves in such a way, but he said that no harm could come of a gentle stroll to stretch our limbs. So I gingerly donned a muslin chemise, and Alexander pulled on only a shirt and breeches. And together, warily, we emerged blinking into the bright yellow sun, walking together to a quiet field where lingering wildflowers dotted the dried stalks and where yellowing leaves rained gently down upon us from the trees. I couldn't remember a time walking anywhere with my husband when the world was so quiet and peaceful and beautiful, a portrait of nature painted by a divine hand. Perhaps we'd already died. Perhaps this was the quiet and peace of heaven. But then, where was God? Matching my husband's stride, I asked, "How do you feel?"
"Much recovered," he said. "And you?"
"Much recovered, too."
And though I feared to speak the words aloud, I thought it best to face it bravely.
"Which means we are soon to die."
"Betsy,"
Alexander scolded, with enough sternness to tell me that he had his wits about him and knew the strange progress of the disease as well as I did.
Aren't you afraid? I asked, knowing he hadn't made his peace with God. And yet my husband, who'd once seemed to crave oblivion, asked, What have I to fear? A pleasing calm suspense?
Let the earth rend. Let the planets forsake their course. Let the sun be extinguished and the heavens burst asunder, were it not for the dread of our children to be left alone.
I crossed my arms at an answer that could only be made by a man who had given the matter some thought. So you fear that we are dying too?
But I wouldn't have said it.
This hardly seemed the time for him to finally learn to govern his tongue. I'd rather not waste time pretending all is well. His eyes squinted in vague amusement.
Do you know, that is the first thing I loved about you. You're entirely without guile.
Now I felt vague amusement. Such flattery.
His shoulders rounded defensively. It's true. I didn't want to love you, Betsy. In truth, I tried not to love you. But your sincerity allowed me to trust you. And I've never completely trusted in anyone else.
Surely that is to overstate it. In answer, he stared far away down the dusty road.
I was too often the victim of bad characters in my childhood. Unscrupulous persons happy to make a dirty, hungry, begging bastard boy imperil his soul for a bit of supper.
He never told stories about that childhood. Never explained how he'd been made a victim of unscrupulous persons. Certainly, he'd never revealed anything he'd done to imperil his soul for a bit of supper. Will you tell me how?
Hamilton's jaw tightened, released, then tightened again. Only if you insist, because it's deeply humiliating. It will also likely vanquish anything that remains of your love, and make me hate myself as an inveterate sinner besides.
I didn't insist. I only walked beside him in silence. Finally, he cleared his throat.
Poverty leaves a tarnish on a boy with no parent to guide him. An indelible stain. But when I met you, a pure angel without pretense, I was vain enough to hope that loving you would cleanse me instead of spatter you with the muck of my past.
And I am sorry, Elizabeth.
I am unworthy of you. I am a creature of a mud pit that I never can seem to climb out of, no matter how hard I try.
Yet he did try.
Everything he'd done had been a mad scramble to escape, to persuade the world that he was not that dirty, hungry, begging bastard boy, but a man of true stature. To persuade me of it.
I'd watched him climb and claw his way back again when he slipped. And I loved him best when, in cold adversity, he'd find within himself the spark of his genius and stoke it to an inferno. But I didn't need him to blaze with glory. I only needed his love. Anger, after all, does not obliterate love, I thought. And I still loved him as strongly as the day I first consented to be his wife. Perhaps stronger now that I knew him better. In these moments, which might be my last, I had to honor that love or die bitter and alone. You were never unworthy of me, Alexander. If anything, I've been unworthy of you. I've not been the wife that you've needed. I hope you'll forgive it.
You have been the best of wives and best of women, beyond what I deserve.
Alexander, I broke in. Belatedly realizing that though he'd failed me, I'd failed him too. I'd known how to be a soldier's wife. I'd grown up knowing. Be strong, be brave, be like my mother. But I'd had no inkling of how to be Alexander Hamilton's wife. And how could I? How could any woman know how to be the wife of a lightning rod? A man who electrified his enemies as well as his friends. He was not merely a soldier nor a statesman. He was a man who was, almost single-handedly, forging an economy, a government, and a nation. He didn't need the finest-tempered girl in the world. He was a lion who had needed a lioness, and I had been a lamb. I'd been too attached to our friendship with the Burrs to have foreseen or prevented that betrayal. Too awed by Jefferson's reputation and eloquence to suspect him for the cold-blooded Jacobin that he was. And too fond of James Madison to suspect that he might be an enemy in truth. And now, when we were so soon to meet our Maker, I wished that I'd never threatened to abandon my husband. It had made me feel stronger to threaten it. It made me feel more valuable to put him in fear. But now I wanted our marriage to be a fortress against all fear in this world and the next. Please forgive me, Alexander, as I forgive you. In the midst of that peaceful country field, he stopped me with a hand upon my elbow. You forgive me? For everything, with all my heart. I reached for his hand, which he took and squeezed like a drowning man. And yet he didn't look convinced.
You say this only because you want to die at peace with me.
But what if we live?
Can you live with...
He shook his head and swallowed, as if remembering our last quarrel.
Can you choose each morning to live with me in forgiveness, despite what I've done?
What had he done, after all? He'd put his hands on another woman. He'd taken momentary pleasure in guttural breaths and animal spasms. Yes, Alexander had done violence to my feelings and to my pride and to our wedding vows. But it all seemed so transient, so temporal now. For whatever wrongs he'd done me, he'd also given me a happier life than I'd believed myself destined for. He'd opened my heart and my mind. He'd taught me to think and to see injustice where I'd not seen it before. He'd taught me to stand for righteous causes. I could do more, and if I lived, I would do more. But first, I forgave my husband, because I was a Christian, because I loved him, and because I must never allow Maria Reynolds to define us. I do so choose to live with you, Alexander Hamilton, I said, as if it were a wedding vow, in forgiveness and grace and love, so long as we draw breath. I expected he would kiss me, but either the illness or the weight of my words forced his knees to go soft. He lowered himself onto the grass of that isolated field, where insects buzzed amongst wild flowers, and the coming harvest stood in a golden line in the distance. And I sat beside him in the waning sun as we leaned, shoulder to shoulder.
You mustn't think that what I did stems from some deficiency in you, he said. The fault was mine, and I'll make of myself a better husband, Betsy. I promise you.
And I will be a different wife, I vowed. I wasn't entirely sure how yet, but I felt more like a woman and less of a girl than I'd ever before been. I think I should prefer henceforth to be called Eliza or Elizabeth, not Betsy. He nodded, clearly moved, his eyes blazing from blue to violet in the late day sun. So be it, my Eliza. Of course, starting anew depended on our surviving. But for now, we had this moment. Perhaps, should we write our last wishes while we're still capable?
After a moment's thought, he said, just letters for the children. After all, we own nothing outright but some furniture, clothing, and paintings.
He gave an exceptionally wry grin.
At last, an advantage to marrying a man without means.
We laughed. We actually laughed. It all seemed so trivial now. The trouble we went to in getting lights and upholstered divans and imported wallpaper with trellises and vines to impress our Federalist friends. We could take none of it with us to the grave, and little good it should do our children. When yellow fever took us, we knew it would be gruesome. We would, by tomorrow or the next day, bleed from every orifice and pore, which made me grateful that I'd sent the children away, so they might never witness the ghastly spectacle. But Alexander and I would not look away. I knew we'd hold one another through every agony until the last drop of blood. Fortunately, God had given us this one last beautiful day, and so we found each other's lips, until we found each other skin to skin as if for the first time, and there we made love beneath his blue sky, revealing ourselves in all our weaknesses to each other and to the Lord. Part 3. The War of Words. Chapter 25. Autumn, 1793, Albany. We were saved. Alexander was certain Dr. Stevenson's remedies had cured us and recommended it to others. But even medicine had become a political battleground. My husband's enemies had allegedly wished him dead, toasting to his speedy demise, and now that he'd survived, they refused to believe in the cure that had saved his life. I wasn't sure I believed it either. It wasn't the baths and the wine and the cinnamon and the Peruvian bark that saved our lives, I thought. It was a miracle. A miracle of grace and love and forgiveness. And we were both changed by it. Our bodies were weaker. Alexander would suffer from kidney pain ever after, and it would be years before I regained my vigor. But our spirits were replenished. Having fallen in love anew, we found within ourselves a new sense of what we valued most. "Mama! Papa!" the children cried as we climbed the hill of the pastures with nothing but the clothes on our backs. "Oh, my babies!" We hugged and kissed every one of them until we were all laughing and crying at the sweetness of the reunion. And we were inexpressibly proud of our brave Philip, who had seen his siblings to safety. As we recovered at my father's house, Alexander decided to resign his position in the government. 6 months and the new government would be on stable footing, maybe less. Having come so close to leaving our children penniless, he intended to return to his law practice and rebuild his fortune. Swinging in a hammock overlooking the Hudson River, he said, "I want to leave my family with more than a memory of me sitting up all night at a desk while mobs shout outside our house. I want to sing duets with the girls at the piano and take the boys duck hunting and plant turnips with me," I mused, nestled against him. Alexander laughed. "What if I were to confess that having lived nearly all my life in a city, I haven't the faintest idea how to grow turnips or any other sort of crop?" Delighted in the way the dappled autumn sunlight illuminated pale freckles upon his face, I kissed him. "I would say you were fortunate to have married a woman who came of age on a farm." He smiled, closing his eyes to the music of our children playing hoops on Papa's lawn. "In this and all things, I must now content myself to be guided by the wisdom of my wife." I was myself content, but our respite was short. A missionary friend of Papa's, wishing to establish a school to help the Oneida, wrote seeking my husband's endorsement and support, not to mention the use of his name. "They wish for me to become a trustee," Alexander said, "and to call it the Hamilton Oneida Academy." This was an honor, I thought, but also a risk to have his name, so often slandered, associated with yet another controversial cause. Yet my husband had championed an enlightened policy toward the Indians, even after the war, when so many others hadn't. "We've done too little to protect them from lawless frontiersmen," he said, as if to convince me, "but perhaps we can provide their children the means for a better life." "Which is why I hope you will accept." He beamed to find us in accord. "Then I will afford it all the aid in my power." I swelled with pride in him, with love for him, and renewed purpose. We returned to Philadelphia after winter's frost to find a city that had been entirely savaged by yellow fever. More than 5,000. Amongst them, doctors, clergymen, black freedmen, a former mayor and members of my Quaker friend's family. Dolly Todd was now left widowed with a small son, forced to rent her stately 3-story brick home on Walnut Street and take up work as a hostess at a boarding house to make ends meet. Despite the slight whiff of scandal that attended Dolly's new situation, I saw to it that she was welcomed at Lady Washington's levees and took food to her whenever I could. 7 months after her husband's death, when the weather was hot again, I took some freshly made ollikokken to the garden entrance of her boarding house and asked, "How are you getting on?" "I trust in heaven that all will be right," Dolly said, ignoring the racket her son was making behind her with a copper pot with a wooden spoon. "Thou art kind to think of me when others are less fortunate." "You are my first stop," I said, motioning to a basket of parcels I intended to deliver to the needy. For in the wake of yellow fever, I'd become convinced that God had spared me for a purpose, not only to remake my marriage, but also to fulfill a calling. Long before I met Alexander Hamilton, standing by the grave of my dead baby brother, I'd felt driven to a vocation, if a woman could have such a thing. And so, just as my husband was seeking to disentangle himself from his public calling, I remembered my own and felt the pull of it, stronger than ever. "I should like to help thee," Dolly said, inviting me in and pouring us each a cup of coffee, while I told her of my charitable plans. "I'd welcome your help, Dolly, though I'm sensible that you're still in mourning." Glancing over her shoulder, as if for fear her mother might overhear, Dolly leaned in to confide, "In truth, I've had an ardent suitor already. 'Tis the custom for a widow to wait, but keen to be wed again, I crave the advice of a woman as sensible as thee." Remembering the trial of my own delayed marriage, I knew it was a difficult thing to wait. But still I advised, "You'll do yourself a great service in the eyes of society to observe the custom." "If I was to observe custom, the wait would be eternal," she said forlornly. "For my suitor is not of my faith, and I shall be shunned if I marry the fellow." "Oh, dear." The churches of my childhood had been Anglican and Dutch Reform. I'd baptized my children at the Episcopal Trinity Church. And having shared services with persons of different faiths, I did not trouble myself with differences of denomination. But the Quakers were much stricter about such things. I sipped at the strong brew as I debated how best to advise her. "Marriage already demands heavy sacrifice. Are you certain your suitor is worthy of it?" "Oh, he is worthy," Dolly said a little breathlessly. "I admire him above all other men. He says he dreams of me and burns with such passion for me that he yearns to relieve his flame." "My goodness," I said, half convinced she would, in her excitement, run off with this honey-tongued lover by night's end. Fanning myself against the heat of summer, or perhaps the heat of Dolly's words, I asked, "Just who is this charming young Romeo?" Dolly bit her pink lip. "An older gentleman. Decidedly good-looking." Several dispossessed but distinguished nobles had recently fled to our shores, so I guessed, "A Frenchman?" "A Virginian," Dolly whispered. "Mr. Madison." I nearly choked on my coffee. She couldn't have surprised me more if she'd named a Barbary pirate. "James Madison?" She nodded in answer, her smile incandescent. "James Madison, the congressman?" "The very same," she chirped. And truly, in that moment, I knew that love was no respecter of persons or explainable passions whatsoever. For I would scarcely have described little Jemmy Madison, professorial and pale as a parson, as decidedly good-looking, nor imagined him yearning for relief for his flame. And though I was wicked enough to take private amusement in this revelation, I knew I must never tell my husband this gossip, or he'd wield it in such merciless mockery that the whole city would be laughing. Well, I said, trying to smother my merriment, will you deprive Philadelphia of its last confirmed bachelor, then? Dolly weighed the question, staring down at her noisy boy. In Mr. Madison, my little child will have a generous and tender protector. But what a price, to give up one's faith. It was a high price, but in the wake of yellow fever, I loved Alexander with such a terrifyingly renewed passion that I believed I might choose him even at the expense of my own soul. And I told her this, whereupon she embraced me with gratitude and a tearful little laugh. Perhaps I will agree to marry him. I fear I never had the soul of a Quaker anyway, or so Senator Burr tells me. Burr? I'd forgotten that he was boarding here. I was too much a Schuyler to have forgiven Burr for ousting my father from the Senate. But because word had recently reached us that Theodosia had died, the victim of a lingering cancer, I softened. How is he bearing up? Dolly shook her head. He's in a terrible grief. It would do the sorrowful man some good to hear kind words before he goes off to New York for her funeral. My friendship with Theodosia had once been close, so I mourned her loss. How much worse for her husband, now facing alone the care of their 11-year-old daughter. I couldn't think it disloyal to offer condolences. Politics be damned. I shall call on Senator Burr, if he's in. Pointing the way, Dolly said, he sits on the balcony overlooking the street while reading. All day, sometimes. I mounted the stairs and found Burr, his boots propped up on a chair, his eyes shadowed by the brim of a hat. Always of a languid air, he looked up from his book with obvious reluctance and blinked.
Do my eyes deceive me, or do I see the wife of the Secretary of the Treasury?
Despite the playful words, Burr's tone was lifeless. Your eyes do not deceive you, Senator Burr. I wanted to tell you how much I regret to hear of the passing of your wife. I remember Theodosia so fondly. When he didn't respond, I went on. In those early days when I was a new mother, she offered me friendship, companionship and advice. I remember how she watched over my children and helped at dinner parties and— Burr said nothing to this litany, but instead stared down at the street, as if he couldn't look at me. And perhaps he couldn't. At the time, I thought that perhaps my condolences weren't welcome, because he couldn't see me as anything other than the wife of a rival. But now I know that Burr was already becoming an empty vessel, more able to separate politics from the personal than any man I'd ever known. Into the awkward silence, I added, Theodosia was a very interesting conversationalist and had a very great spirit. Still he said nothing, and I wished I hadn't come on this errand. Please take comfort in knowing that Theodosia loved you. Hoping that was enough to extricate myself, I turned to go. He stopped me with a chuckle.
And do you consider yourself an expert in love?
For a moment I knew not what to say. What an odd creature Burr was. I attributed it to his grief. But then he said,
Mrs. Hamilton, I know.
Confused, I peered back at him, and the shrewd cast of his eyes turned my blood to ice. He wasn't responding to what I said. He knew. Somehow, Burr had learned of my husband's infidelity, and he was laughing. For a moment, I dared not move a muscle lest I betray my horror. Steadying myself, I looked to the street below. Horses cantered, wagon wheels clacked, men called to one another. But I heard not a sound but the beating of my own heart. Then Burr's cough.
That was ill done of me, he said,
with what might have passed for chagrin in any other man. I realize now that he wasn't entirely capable of it.
My wife's death has apparently stolen my capacity for subtlety.
I assumed you were aware of your husband's indiscretion, and because you're not an actress of any talent, I see that you are aware.
For a moment, I considered whether I could throw him from that balcony. Responses flashed through my mind, one more horrible than the next, until he forestalled any reply with his next revelation.
Mrs. Reynolds has retained me as a lawyer in filing for divorce.
It was all I could do to blank my expression. To think that we'd convinced Monroe and the other investigators to keep quiet, only for my husband's harlot to tell tales. And because I was, more and more, learning to think like my husband, I worried it might become a matter of court record in a divorce proceeding. Burr seemed to read my mind.
I've advised Mrs. Reynolds to mention nothing of her connection to Hamilton. She will instead accuse her own husband of adultery, and the scoundrel doesn't dare contest it. So I think the matter that concerns you has a good chance to remain a private one, and I will do my best to keep it that way. I hope that gives you some peace of mind.
That was unexpected.
Burr didn't have to advise Maria Reynolds to keep quiet.
Indeed, he had no motive to do so, so I was immediately suspicious. Why would you—
Friendship, my dear lady,
Burr said, as if it should be obvious.
I've never seen a reason why a mere difference in politics should be a reason for personal discord.
His words brought to mind the dinner table policy I'd once naively embraced. Perhaps this reassuring message is better delivered to my husband.
By my reckoning, Hamilton has less of a right to reassurance than you do,
Burr said, eyeing me levelly.
You're the one I wish to comfort.
My throat tightened, and yet I came to offer you comfort.
I cannot be comforted.
That's when the impenetrable armor of Burr's character, which made it so easy for him to slip from one political faction to another, amiable to all, sincere to none, fell away.
My wife was the best woman and finest lady I ever knew. And now I go to attend her funeral knowing I never made enough time to attend her in life.
He said this bitterly.
Do you know, I offered to give up my ambitions and leave government for her. Theodosia wouldn't have it. Now she's gone and ambition is all that's left.
I should have heard the threat in those words. But at the time, my heart filled with such pity for his agony that I took the liberty of squeezing his hand, never dreaming that same hand would one day inflict that same agony upon me. September, 1794, Philadelphia. It was a time for terror. For 2 years, the French Revolution had depended upon it. Now, a flood of refugees washed into our American capital, so many that the French language rang out on every street corner. Even the newspapers featured advertisements in that language for everything from wines and perfumes to fencing lessons and theater performances. And the refugees brought with them chilling tales of abuse and deprivation, horrifying stories of victims shortened by the national razor, their silently screaming heads held up for the jeers of the crowd, still dripping bloody red gore.
"Quelle horreur,"
said Mr. Moreau, the owner of the bookstore on the corner of Walnut Street. I'd come to replenish my husband's ever-dwindling supply of paper and ink, as well as to purchase a book of French for Anna, who was learning the language from a tutor. The store was also a meeting place for some of the most prominent French exiles, and Mr. Moreau knew them all.
"Pour victime de Noailles,"
he said, rummaging amongst the clutter of maps, engravings, and scientific instruments for sale.
"He hasn't come out of his house for days."
Noailles was Lafayette's brother-in-law, and he, too, had fought heroically for us at Yorktown. Now Noailles found himself persecuted, forced into flight, and grieving the murders of those he'd left behind in France. Women of Lafayette's family, too.
"Last I saw the victim," Moreau continued, "he kept murmuring that his wife must have been spattered by her own mother's blood going up the stairs to the guillotine, that he should have divorced her when he fled so as to spare her this fate.
Clutching Anna's book in my gloved hands, I said a silent prayer. He couldn't have known that the monsters would come for women and children.
No, Moreau agreed. But maybe his wife could have renounced him. Maybe it would have saved her.
Stand by him and die, renounce him and live. I wondered, in her place, what I would have done.
My husband was determined that I should never find out.
I must leave you, Alexander whispered softly the next morning, regretfully rising from my pillow as dawn glowed rosy in our window. There was an uprising in western Pennsylvania against the whiskey tax my husband had levied to pay the country's war debt. Tax collectors had been tarred and feathered. Whiskey rebels had blown up the stills of their neighbors who paid the tax. They'd kidnapped a federal marshal. They'd even threatened to build a guillotine, here, in America. President Washington had been forced to muster an army. He would lead it, personally, against these rebels to establish, once and for all, that the laws of this new nation must be obeyed. That terror here would not be countenanced. And Alexander meant to ride out at the president's side. My husband reassured our children that there'd be no real fighting, that a show of force would be enough. But I also heard him tell a friend that the game afoot was for no less than true liberty, property, order, and heads. I was no young bride anymore, confronted for the first time with the terror of her union being torn asunder, of losing a man who'd become a part of her to the vagaries of war. I was older and wiser. Wise enough to say, but you're the Secretary of the Treasury, not the Secretary of War.
Regardless, Jefferson is calling this Hamilton's insurrection, and in a government like ours, the proposer of a measure which involves dangers to his fellow citizens should partake in that danger.
So now you admit there will be danger. I wanted to know the truth of what we faced, all of it. Is Jefferson our Robespierre? I asked, searching my husband's eyes, wondering how scared I should be. Would he cheerfully condemn us to the guillotine and lap up our blood?
No, Alexander said, stroking my cheek.
But lest I think he said it only to comfort me, he added,
that philosophical fool would be forced to mount the scaffold behind us, a victim of the same mob he's emboldened.
Alexander wouldn't allow a repeat of the Citizen Genet affair, with mobs threatening us on our doorstep. He meant to take the fight to the rebels this time. But what if he doesn't return? I shook the thought away. If I was sick with worry, it was because I was with child again. Proof of our love and mutual desire. Proof of forgiveness and grace. This baby represented something new and hopeful between Alexander and me, and it pained me to think that after such a long struggle, everything remained so fragile. But I was determined to be his lioness now, so I asked no more questions and said nothing more about my fears. Instead, I drew him back to our warm bed and, climbing astride, reminded him of that intimate day in a faraway field, when we made love like a sacrament. At my boldness, Alexander's hands gripped my hips, his heated interest making me wish I'd been bolder in love before.
A new start indeed, Eliza.
Later that day, I saw him off on Market Street, where he prepared to ride out to war with the aging president. I didn't care what anyone else said. The sight of even an aging George Washington still inspired me and stiffened my spine, and so I teased my husband. At long last, it seems, I have persuaded you to return to the side of your general. We'd come far enough that Hamilton smiled.
It seems you shall always have your way.
Then come back to me, I said, fighting my own battle against foreboding and kissing him farewell. Martha Washington and I clasped hands as we watched them go. Then I spent the next 2 months trying to keep the children from missing their father as much as I did. The boys had their schooling, but as my daughter was 10 years of age, and Fanny only a few months younger, I took them for lessons from the French dance master, and while they danced, I collected donations and delivered them to the needy.
"Voici le chapeau idéal pour Monsieur le Secrétaire, Madame,"
said Madame Legrand from behind the hatter's stall in the market. She held up a black felt riding hat with a black cockade.
"Yes, I'll take the hat. Merci,"
I replied, fishing money from my purse, as Madame Legrand's two barefooted children wrestled in the cold street over a loaf of bread. Not old enough to help their mother look after their hatter's stall in the market, they were lean as wild dogs, and dressed in rags that offered them no defense against the weather. And though I knew it shamed Madame Legrand and the other refugees to rely upon charity, they had little choice unless they would starve.
"Take this as well," I said, pressing into her hand a pouch of donations I'd collected for her. "And if you come by the house on Sunday morning before church service, I'll have some warm clothes that my children have outgrown."
"Merci,"
Madame Legrand said, clutching the pouch against her faded linen dress, worn without stays, her eyes lowered. She'd had a little cottage outside Paris, with a flower garden, a fine tea service. Now, without a husband, she had nothing. Alone and desperate, and I had cause to imagine myself in her miserable condition, as Madame Legrand thanked me again and again, boxing up a hat for my husband that he might never wear.
"Mrs. Hamilton!"
I turned to see Dolly in a swish of red cloak, a veritable rainbow of ribbons flowing from her fancy bonnet. Freed from Quaker restraint, she was never plain now.
"Is that a surprise for the secretary?"
"Oh, yes," I answered.
"When my husband returns home, I should like to present him with a little gift." A basket of apples looped over one arm, Dolly glanced at my pregnant belly and chirped,
"I should think a baby the very best gift of all, or so Mr. Madison tells me."
She'd married him, even though it meant expulsion from her faith, even though it put a little distance between us because of the estrangement of our husbands. But I didn't blame her. In marrying Madison, she'd lifted her child from poverty to wealth in one stroke. And despite the strangeness of the pairing, the Madisons were a love match.
"Well, then, do you mean to give Mr. Madison the gift he most desires?"
"As soon as I can,"
Dolly replied, and then, with a twinkle that proved she really never did have the soul of a Quaker, she added,
"I'm certainly making every effort to procure it all hours of the night."
Halfway between scandalized and horrified by the image that conjured, I laughed too hard, and a sharp pain knifed through my abdomen. Doubling over, I gasped as the market suddenly spun, assaulting me with the sound of horse hooves on cobblestones, passing wagons, brooms being whacked free of dust in doorways. The roar of grocers in the market shouting the price of mustard, apples, and sugar. I dropped my purse. And Dolly Madison was at my elbow.
"Let's get her home," she was saying to a black man who steadied me.
One of her husband's slaves, I suspected. And in a swirl of half-formed, absurd thoughts, I couldn't help but wonder, given the Quaker's strict anti-slavery position, what she thought of now owning slaves herself. Next I knew, I was jostling in the carriage beside her, shivering with cold. Then I was being put into bed.
"Here, drink this,"
Dolly said, bringing hot chocolate that she'd stirred together in my kitchen. I nodded, starting to come back to myself, the pain easing.
"Thank you, Dolly."
"You poor thing. You must be worried for your husband."
I blew out a breath, torn, perhaps ridiculously, between worry over my unborn child and worry over admitting to the wife of a political rival that I was concerned about my husband's expedition against the whiskey rebels.
"I'm sure everything's all right," I said, trying to convince myself on both accounts.
For I had now only the slightest of cramps. I wanted to say more. I wanted to confide my worries to her. And I nearly convinced myself that I should. After all,
Dolly and I had been friends before she met Madison, and I did hold a glimmer of hope that she might be a good influence on him politically, especially now that Mr. Jefferson had retired into private life. Hamilton feared that this retirement from President Washington's cabinet was just a ruse, that Jefferson was biding his time until he could run for the presidency himself. But to me, the important thing was that Jefferson was gone. In Jefferson's absence, Madison had supported my husband's whiskey tax. Jemmy also denounced the insurrection as odious. So maybe there was reason for optimism that fences could be mended with our old friend. Still, I knew better than to confess anything that might be used against Alexander, even my own fears for his survival. I think I've simply taken a chill, I added cautiously. Well, then, I shall let you get your rest, Dolly replied, tucking a shawl around my shoulders. She seemed to sense my caution, and perhaps was as saddened by it as I was. Before she left, she pledged $10 to help French distressed persons, but I feared even charity was too feeble a bridge between us. In the days that followed, I was apt to burst into tears without warning or explanation at the slightest provocation, or no provocation at all. What's wrong with me? I worried that, like one of those pendulums with which Papa was so fascinated, swinging back and forth, there was a divine balance of happiness afforded to any one person. God had spared us. He had spared Alexander and me from death, divorce, and bitter acrimony. Will the price for that mercy now be the life of the baby inside me, or the life of my husband at war? If Angelica had been with me, she would have said I was ascribing altogether too much importance to myself in the plans of the deity, and I dared not confess my fears to anyone else lest they think me mad. Certainly, I couldn't confess it to Lady Washington, or Abigail Adams, or Lucy Knox, all of whom, in warm shawls and dowdy bonnets, mounted an assault upon my household in near military formation, even though I protested I was too sick to receive them. Determined to combat my malaise, Mrs. Knox hovered above my bed and huffed, "Parsley is just the thing. Strong tea is better," insisted Mrs. Adams, elbowing her way forward. "Dried figs," Lady Washington serenely stated, setting a basket of them at my bedside. "Figs ease everything for a pregnant woman." And though I could see they did not agree, the other Federalist ladies were forced out of deference to bend to the President's lady. "Don't trouble yourself about the children, my dear," Martha Washington insisted, patting my hand. "I will take little Fanny and Anna in my carriage to dancing school so you can get your rest. All will be well." But by the time Alexander returned, victorious over the rebels, having restored order to the country and banished the specter of the guillotine, I had delivered a tiny, misshapen, dead babe. It would have been a girl. A little girl. I'd hoped for another daughter. A third sister for Anna and Fanny to love. The two of them were already inseparable, but I'd imagined them, the three of them, piling into a bed together and laughing like Angelica, Peggy, and I used to do. And now I couldn't be consoled of the loss, not even when Alexander burst in the door, clasping me in his strong arms. "I'm sorry, so sorry," I wept violently against my husband's chest. "I lost her. I wasn't strong enough to keep her." Alexander rocked me, tears in his own eyes.
"Blame your heartless husband for leaving you. My absence was the cause. It's my fault, my beloved, my angel, my Eliza."
He was not heartless. He was a hero. He'd saved the country yet again. The rebellion was smashed, the primacy of federal laws firmly established. The government had passed its first test. And yet,
When we put quietly into an unmarked grave my dead child who couldn't be baptized nor named, I couldn't find enough patriotism within myself to feel anything but grief.
"She's cold," I whispered, awakened by the ghostly cry of an